Well, hello, runners. Welcome to episode 32 of the I Run Things podcast, the podcast for the everyday runner in search for that extra bit of motivation to get out there. My name is Susie, and I am your host. In today's episode, we chat with Liz Warner about her project, Run to Reach. Run to Reach is Liz Warner's personal and international fundraising effort to support global communities by completing 30 marathons in 30 countries before turning 30. In this episode, she shares what ignited the sparkle to start this unbelievable challenge, which communities she helped, and how this project changed her. If you want to learn more about Liz and the Run to Reach project, visit her site, runtoreach.com, or message her on Instagram at runtoreach. I also wanted to apologize for not releasing this episode last week on Thursday as was scheduled. Things have been a little bit crazy around here, and this week and next, our episode will be released on Monday instead of on Thursdays, as usually. And now, without further ado, let's play the interview with Liz. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Susie?
I'm great. And I am so excited to have you. Because
I'm super excited to be on as well.
Yeah, I was obviously doing my research and checking your website and all your social media platforms. And it's just giving me the chills to think about what you've done, what you have accomplished. And I can't wait to hear more about what your next endeavors are going to be. So just let's get to it. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Great. Sure. So about, I guess, almost 2 years ago, I was on my honeymoon and had just gotten married, and I came up with this crazy idea to run 30 marathons in 30 countries before I turned 30, which was going to be, yeah, I was 28 at the time when I thought of this crazy idea. And so that's sort of what I've been up to for the past year and a half. I said yes to this crazy idea, and I've sort of been on the road, traveling to all these different marathons and countries, but also sort of the biggest purpose behind the project was that in each of the countries that I'd be running in, I partnered with a local women-focused organization. So I would travel to these countries and actually spend the majority of the time meeting with these NGOs, trying to shine a spotlight on what they do and sort of maximize the exposure for them, try to fundraise along the way, and then at the end, I would run the race. So I completed the project back in June, all 30 marathons. Of course, the final two marathons got a little bit, the project was sidetracked because of COVID, but I still, you know, somehow made it work. But yeah, the project is called Run to Reach, and it definitely was a huge, huge, huge marker in my life now.
Right. I bet. What is your background? Did you always, even before you got married and you decided to do this, was this a purpose of your life?
Yes. So I cheated a little bit in this project because I actually already run 8 marathons when I came up with this idea. And my background, I'm currently living in Paris, but before that I was living in Japan. I moved to Japan right after finishing university. For no like very big reason, I just wanted a big adventure, and I got an internship which turned into a job there. And right also when I moved to Japan, my father suddenly passed away, and so maybe a 6 months. Oh, thank you so much. But yeah, the reason I sort of mentioned that detail is because 6 months into living in Japan, I decided to sign up for a marathon, never really having run, you know, that long a distance before at all. And, you know, it really was such a transformative period of my life where I grew to love running. And, you know, as soon as I crossed the finish line of that first marathon, that was it. And then I started traveling for different marathons and meeting such incredible people along the way. So, you know, when I say that this project kind of came out of nowhere, like that would be a lie, because I definitely, I felt ready to take on a project that combined my two loves in life, you know, my two big passions, which was running and traveling, but really pushing myself out of my comfort zone along the way, while also doing my best in, you know, making a positive impact on the world, as cliche as that sounds, but that really was what I wanted to do with this project. And it was a beautiful journey. You know, I think also when I initially was organizing this project, mind you, I organized everything in 2 months, which was,
oh, wow.
which in retrospect, yeah, it was, I wish I had 2 years to organize everything, but I had 2 months to plan everything. And originally, you know, I kind of chose marathons in countries that I was really excited to travel to, of course, because for me, it was like, okay, I quit my job. Like, this is a year and a half long sabbatical. But then maybe a few months into the project, I realized, you know, it'd be so much more interesting from a development perspective to really go to some far-reaching, interesting countries like Afghanistan and Yemen and, you know, Sierra Leone, countries that are not often traveled to. And so that's right. Really what I sort of became the focus of my project eventually.
How were you able to pull this off? Because 2 months is not a lot of time, even without having to do research on which, you know, nonprofits or, you know, NGOs you want to really help out. Absolutely. How did you decide on that?
It was a very stressful period. I mean, it was one of, you know, it really felt like I was starting my own business almost, like in a way where I was working, or I was sort of at my computer maybe 20 hours of the day, but, you know, I was exhausted, but at the same time, so exhilarated by this whole process of doing something that, you know, just charged me in all the right ways. You know, it was very tricky because, again, you know, I had to sort of piece together this marathon schedule because I wanted to space them out at least like a week or two in between each other. But choosing the NGOs was actually the most important and the most, I feel like it definitely was what I put the most time towards, because I think also when I started Run to Reach, I was a bit disillusioned by the NGO world in general. And I feel like you hear, or I read about so many stories where certain NGOs were not always doing the right thing and you just didn't know where your money would go towards. And so I really made it a huge effort to not only find organizations that I really connected with, but also made sure that they were extremely transparent in what they do. Because in the long run, when it came time down to it, I would have to communicate on what they, you know, on what they do. And so, and I also wanted to establish a relationship with them beforehand and really, you know, as much as I was going to put a lot of effort into sort of, really shining light on their work, I also wanted them to, you know, be willing to support me as well. So, it was tricky. I honestly probably prepared like 75% of the project, where I chose like the majority of the NGOs. And I sort of towards the end, I had this gut feeling that it was going to change along the way and that this project was going to evolve. And that's really what I told myself from day one, like, allow yourself space and time to pivot, because it's not going to be exactly how you plan it now. I mean, especially even from a financial perspective, like, I did not have a plan for this. And very naively, I also assumed like I would get sponsored or I could find a way to, you know, have someone really financially support me along the way. And that was not the case. I mean, I did, you know, make it work. I found ways, but it wasn't definitely was not as easy as I initially thought. And it was, yeah, it was a little bit, you know, it was very stressful, that aspect of it, because as much as I wanted it to be, oh, you know, I'm just traveling around the world, like I had to make it work financially and also just, you know, energy wise as well. I think I also was very scared at a certain point I would get burnt out, because there was almost maybe a 5 month period where I just didn't even come home because I was just trying to save costs. And so yeah, so it ended up just being a whirlwind adventure. And yeah, I think looking back again, I wish I had more time to plan, but you know, it's the kind of project that if you don't say yes now, you're never gonna end up doing it. So
right. And I find that the best projects are the ones that happen like you're explaining, just let's do it, you know, like let's figure out a way to do it. So yes. Having more time to plan for something, does not necessarely mean that it's going to come out better, that the outcome is going to be better. I mean, obviously you fulfilled your goal, which was to run the 30 marathons before you turned 30. So,
yeah.
And did you choose? So my understanding is that you chose a different NGO for each marathon you were running.
Correct. Correct.
Right.
Yeah. But they were all, I think when I was choosing the NGOs originally, you know, I was choosing some environmental based NGOs, and then I said, you know, I was making it more complicated for myself, because even from a marketing perspective, at the end of the day, the fundraising component of this project was very important. If anything, it was the most important. Like, yes, I wanted to shine light on the work that these NGOs were doing, but I wanted to give to them in some substantial way. And so that's when I decided all the NGOs I would be working with, they would all be sort of a women empowerment NGOs. If that meant they were, you know, more health focused or providing financial services to women, but that they would be collectively empowering women on a global scale. So that's really sort of the theme amongst all of them. And I think that that really sort of brought my project together for myself. And also when I was communicating to these NGOs, you know, this is what I'm doing. And so that made it a little bit easier along the way, just from like a marketing perspective, to have that sort of central theme. And it also made it really interesting for me, because like I said, all the NGOs did very different things. So it was just a huge learning experience for me. You know, sort of really working with these smaller, like there's maybe only one or two organizations that were on a medium to larger scale, but most of these NGOs were quite small. So it was a really eye-opening, amazing experience getting to work with all of them.
So how, that was going to be one of my questions. How deep did you go in working with them? Did you sit down with them next? Like, did you, were you part of their efforts on a day-to-day basis for a period of time? Or
yes, I mean, I also, how can I put this? I didn't want to sort of just show up and be like, I'm volunteering for 2 weeks. Like I felt like my purpose was to use my platform again to explain what they did. I didn't want to just, because for me, you know, I have sort of my own perspective on volunteerism. And I think there are some incredible projects out there, but I just personally knew that, you know, what I could offer to them when I, you know, visited these countries was to just really understand what they do and to try to make it into some kind of like visual compelling story that I could show to my potential donors to Rent to Reach. And in that, yes, I met almost all of them. And again, that's sort of going back to when I was first contacting the NGOs, I made it a very important point that, you know, I was traveling all the way there. I really want to see their work or talk to, you know, to one of their members or beneficiaries. If it's possible, even meet with some of the staff as well. You know, I also understood that this was a lot to ask of these NGOs as well. You know, they weren't being paid to meet with me. You know, they have right. only a certain number of resources. So yeah, there were maybe one or two instances where I thought I was going to meet with them and it just didn't work out. I mean, also from like a traveling to some of the projects, the logistics just was a little bit complicated, but that was, you know, really enriching experience for me. And that's really sort of how I went into working with all of the NGOs.
Right. And now let's talk a little bit about the actual marathons. Yeah. Because you did not shy away from places that could be considered quote unquote dangerous. Like you yeah. went to Yemen, you went to Somaliland, yeah. You've been in places where, and I don't want to sound, but being a woman,
yeah,
I know many men who would not want to go. So being a yeah. woman, you have the guts because, you know, many people around the globe would be scared of even just going, much less, yeah. you know, trying to get to meet with local people and trying to find out more about, you know, these organizations that are going to be working with people who are, you know, in need of assistance, yeah. you know, in need of money, yeah. in need of food, in need of shoes, yeah. in need of clothes. So I am sure that was not easy. Were you ever at any point, did you ever feel fear? Like, where did you ever feel in any of these trips that you did scared?
I mean, that's a good question. I did, but it had nothing to do really with the countries I traveled to. It was mostly just, the fact that I was traveling alone as a woman. And I say that, you know, the situations that I felt fear, it could have happened here in Paris, you know,
right.
where I live. And so, you know, I think there were definitely moments where I was like, it's really hard traveling alone as a woman. It just is. And right. I really, you know, I sort of went into traveling to all these places with a big open mind and then sort of a few months in, you know, I had to just accept the fact that, you know, my day ended once it got dark and I wasn't going to continue to put myself at, you know, risky situations. Obviously the likelihood of something happening would be low, but you just need to avoid certain risk, like traveling as a woman. But I think going to places like Afghanistan, I should also say that I did not travel there alone. I went with a reputable tour group that travels there often. And so they were very up to date with, you know, the current political situation and everything. And we never went close to any government buildings, and that's sort of where the high risk area are. So, it is all relative. And I, as soon as we got to Afghanistan, we spent a few days in Kabul, and that was a little bit iffy. We had to be more careful there. But as soon as we got to where the marathon was taking place, which was a 2-hour flight from Kabul in this area called Bamyan, I actually walked around this small town, you know, by myself as a foreign woman. Like, even though I had my hair covered up, I felt very safe. People were inviting me into their homes for tea. It's just that really incredible hospitality that you hear of in these, you know, countries that are often so often equated with violence and conflict. I really don't have so much fear going to any of these places, knowing that there are such kind, hospitable, warm people there. It's funny because in March, when the world was shutting down because of COVID, I had just finished the marathon in Yemen, on Socotra Island. And there was a high chance that we were going to get stranded there because France had closed its borders. There was only one flight per week off of this island in Yemen. And I sort of said to myself, like, I had my husband on my satellite phone and he was freaking out, of course, because Yemen's not doing so great right now. I mean, there's a huge civil war going on there, but I I just believe in humanity at this point, especially doing this project. And I knew that no matter what, if I was going to be stranded in Yemen for 2 to 3 months, I would find extremely kind people that would take care of me. And, or that would just, you know, would make it a very exciting, powerful experience. And I think that's just, yeah, that's just sort of the outlook I have on traveling to all these places, that at the end of the day, conflict is never the whole story. And there are extremely kind, hospitable people that also want to show you that their country is more than what you would see in the headlines or on the news, et cetera.
Right. So which one was your, and this is a tough question. So which ones are your favorite? Like which, out of the 30, which ones left a mark, like a positive impression in you?
A really tough question. It's honestly choosing between children. Yeah. But, you know, I think in terms of most eye-opening experience, 100% Afghanistan. I mean, it was beyond, so the marathon itself took place in this national park, called Bandi Amir, and it just looks like the Grand Canyon. There are these, you know, towering hills and these turquoise lakes. Like, it was stunning landscape. And again, just kind of like completely mind-boggling that this would be in a country that, again, very few people would travel to. And on top of that, what was so cool about this marathon is there were 50 Afghan women who were running the race alongside me. And there was actually, I was there partnering with this organization called Free to Run. And they actually work with Afghan women, providing them safe spaces for them to exercise and run and sort of gain life skills through sports. So it was just so powerful to get to run alongside these really strong, fierce Afghan women, hear their stories. You know, you also sort of imagine most Afghan women would be, you know, would not have so much kind of voice and agency. But I mean, these women were telling me that they wanted to be president and that they had just, you know, finished Michelle Obama's book. And, you know, they were very cultured, just very strong women. And I mean, again, it was just a very eye-opening experience, even for me going into, you know, traveling there and running there. Beyond that, I did a marathon in Patagonia, and that was just, I think aesthetically, it was just a really like stunning landscape. But each was, you know, I did a marathon in Sierra Leone, and that was actually my first marathon I did with my husband. He tagged along with me on this trip, and he was supposed to only run 5 kilometers. There was like a 5 kilometer race, a 10 kilometer race, and then the marathon. And maybe 2 days before, I was like, Mark, run the full marathon with me. Like, we're here in Sierra Leone. It's just beautiful, like jungle landscape. And he said yes. So so that marathon itself was really special to me, because obviously I did it with him and we walked most of it, honestly. But I wouldn't make him run a full marathon just overnight. But you know, each marathon was just such a story and an experience. And I think I would also purposely always have the marathon at the very end of the trip, and so I'd have this really kind of powerful experience like a week or two beforehand, either meeting with the NGO or traveling a little bit to see some of the country. And so, you know, every single race I'd sort of be reflecting on everything that happened the week before and how this was sort of all making sense to me and in my project, and how life-changing each of these experiences were.
Right. Which one was the smallest in runners and participants?
So the marathon in Somaliland was very small. I went there with a friend, and a friend who I actually met in Sierra Leone, and then I dragged her to Somaliland with me, and we were the only two women running that marathon. So, in fact, yeah, we obviously came in first and second place, which is kind of fun. But but that marathon was interesting because, I mean, it's Somaliland itself. It's, you should not confuse it with Somalia. Somalia obviously has a lot. It is a very dangerous country, and that's a country I actually do not think I would travel to, just because the likelihood of something happening is actually quite high. But Somaliland is not an internationally recognized country, but it is separate from Somalia. It's extremely safe, but it is conservative. So the temperatures, it was very hot that day. It was maybe like 95 degrees Fahrenheit, 34 degrees Celsius. And we had to be fully covered from head to toe. And so that marathon was just tough for those reasons. Also, the race itself, it was just, 26 miles, like 42K long, a straight desert road. So it was tough mentally. It was really tough. And, but the one positive, because we were the only women, there was sort of this car behind us, that was sort of just making sure that, like, okay, these two like foreign women are running 42 Ks in Somaliland, they're going to be okay. And so there was kind of this security car behind us the whole time. So whenever we like really needed water, we like just stop the security car behind us. And, but yeah, that definitely had to be the smallest race, but it was still, a really powerful one because there were quite a number of Somali women who ran the 10K. So that was really cool to see, but yeah, I would say the more obscure races, they were definitely like 50 or less people running them.
One I wanted to ask you about is it's close to my heart. I went many yeah. years ago, like 20 years ago, but the one in Egypt that you ran to, yes. Luxor, I didn't even know there was a marathon there.
It's beautiful. Obviously, Luxor is just, oh my gosh, the history is like,
it's breathtaking. Yeah.
It's breathtaking. It's absolutely overwhelming. The marathon itself, it was four loops kind of around the town, but what was so cool is like there were these small like 10-year-old girls, and they were just following me for maybe like a mile or like a kilometer around each loop, and that's what made it really fun. But yeah, it was a beautiful race. The Egyptian people are so kind. So this year there actually weren't that many international runners. So I think also when the race is more local, it also feels kind of special in a way as well, that they're really trying to push more local runners to be involved and get involved with marathon running. So I loved that as well about this race. But yeah, Egypt is just incredible. And I also think sometimes it has a bad rep as well with travelers. Obviously there have been some terrorist attacks in the past, but it's just a beautiful country. The people are so kind, and I traveled there alone and felt perfectly safe, honestly, too.
And you've done a lot of races in the Middle East.
Yeah.
One I really wanted to talk to you about, the one in Tindouf, this Sahara Marathon, because this is like, Tindouf is like a refugee, isn't it? Like a refugee site?
Yes. So it's funny you say that too, because that was maybe the second marathon in this project that I did, and it was such just a mind expanding experience, because you spend a week first living with a local or with a refugee family and sort of get to really spend time with them, see their day to day, understand the conflict that I was completely unaware about before traveling there. And I actually traveled with a smaller NGO. I know that the marathon itself, you can go sort of as a larger group with the marathon, but I actually traveled there with a local UK-based organization. So that's, it made the experience, you know, even more intimate in that way. And yeah, running in the desert is something else. I think if I could choose any sort of terrain that I just grew to love running around or running on, it's definitely the desert and sort of that sensation of being alone in the desert. And but yeah, you know, I think it's, you know, I'm still in touch with the woman that I ended up staying with for the week. And again, it's just, you know, I'm actually still working with the NGO now. It was really an experience. You know, of course, I have an emotional connection to each of the NGOs, but I think coming out of that marathon and really getting to spend, you know, significant amount of time with the people who are benefiting sort of from the projects and from the money being raised, it just, I mean, I returned back to Paris and I was pretty kind of lost for a few days just because it was a really, you know, earth-shattering experience for me. And the fact that this conflict is just, it's not even ignored. It's not even known by the majority of the world. And there are almost 200,000 refugees living in that one refugee camp near Tindouf. So, right. So, and it was, I think that project, that's also sort of going back to when I was talking about how I reevaluated the countries I was going to. Once I started communicating about this marathon and the NGO and the refugee camps, there were so many people who were like, wow, I've never heard of this conflict before. And that's when I sort of determined that I was going to be going to countries that would be really interesting for other people to learn about, you know? So yeah, but that was an amazing marathon. I would definitely recommend you doing it or any of the listeners. It really was probably honestly one of the most powerful out of the big list of marathons I did over this project.
I also wanted to talk about the your virtual marathon.
So the 29th marathon, the second to last marathon, was virtual. And yeah, it honestly was such a silver lining in this crazy kind of lockdown, COVID, the world coming to an end period. You know, of course, I did make it back to Paris from Yemen. And I actually, the week while I was in Yemen, I didn't have internet. And as soon as I got internet, I received a message from my sister saying, Liz, like, I know you haven't checked the news, but like, the world is essentially coming to an end in like the least dramatic way possible. And like your project will probably have to be put on hold. I just want you to know that. Don't freak out. There will be another creative way for you to finish it. And, you know, I got back to Paris and literally the world had stopped and paused. And, you know, they were actually, which almost feels ridiculous saying out loud, there were a number of people who were like, are you okay? Like, obviously your project has to end now. You're so close to finishing. And I mean, obviously in the grand scheme of things, like my project is not the biggest thing happening right now in the world. But I never saw it as something that needed to be delayed or postponed. Like I was going to finish it one way or another. If that's, you know, obviously my last two marathons were canceled. I had very big plans to do the Everest marathon as my final 30th marathon. I had a film crew coming to film the whole experience and, you know, there were big plans. But so this virtual race, you know, I decided maybe a few weeks after returning to Paris, at the end of the day, you know, everyone's at home now. Some people are able to go running outside. How cool would it be to actually involve people in my project? And I feel like at that point in my project, I had a decent number of people who were closely following what I was doing. And so I just opened the invitation. I was also raising money for the WHO's COVID-19 Response Fund. And I mean, it was such a amazing experience because I also set the goal for myself. I was trying to get at least 100 countries involved in this virtual race. I didn't, you know, of course I wanted as many people as possible, but for me, I wanted it to be as diverse as possible. And so for maybe like 3 weeks, 4 weeks, I was on an rampage on Instagram and I was reaching out to runners in Djibouti, in, you know, Haiti and Jamaica, like all these countries. And it was so cool. And I ended up, you know, really forging relationships out of this by people, you know, I sort of pitched it to runners. I didn't know. It's like, you know, I've done this project for the past year and a half. Like obviously COVID has messed things up, but I would be honored for you to represent your country in this race. And people, I don't know, it worked and they got really excited. I ended up raising more money from this virtual race than like honestly the past 5 marathons combined, just because I think people felt, you know, like they were also, you know, really a part of my project instead of just sort of watching me go to a country and run the race and that was right. That. Like they were actually really involved themselves. So it was, yeah, it was honestly one of the biggest highlights from the 18-month project, truly. And I just felt so lucky to connect with so many people around the world who were obviously united in this pandemic situation, as horrible as it is to say. Like it really did bring us all together. And it just was cool to see people so excited by this virtual race, because obviously there's so many virtual races happening. And so that also made me hesitant, like, should I do this? There's so much competition. People are a little bit sick of virtual races. But in fact, it turned out to be a really cool experience. And then the final marathon was, you know, the first week of June. There were not many borders that were open yet, but I was still determined to find a country, a different country than France, that I could go and just run my final marathon by myself. And I was thinking about Italy, but I was sort of, flights at the time were really expensive. And I was like, why? Okay, I had no idea what I was going to do. And then one of my friends was like, oh, why don't you like try Andorra, which I had never heard. I had never heard of this country before. And it's like, I know it sounds terrible. I think I had heard of it, but I sort of assumed it was part of Spain. I didn't realize it was its own country. So then I contacted the tourism board, again, explained my project. This is my final race. Like, it's really exciting for me at least. And they were, you know, got on board. You know, they made sure, I think the country had just opened its borders to France, not even to Spain yet. And I ended up driving down there with my husband and sort of made a whole trip out of it. And also the final race coincided with the Black Lives Matter movement. So while I still ended up supporting the NGO I was originally supposed to work with in Nepal for the Everest Marathon, I decided now is the best time to try to raise money for anti-racist organizations that are doing such incredible work. And obviously there is so much attention, you know, really good attention around this issue. So that's sort of what I focused my last Andorra marathon on. But it was, you know, a beautiful experience just because Andorra itself is just a gorgeous country, very mountainous. Like I couldn't walk for weeks after that race. But it was a very cool experience. I was really, really happy to end it there.
Yeah, Andorra is beautiful. Lots of good skiing in Andorra.
Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah. And then after that, you know, you accomplish all this. How did you decide to do an ultra in Tunisia? Because that is mind-blowing. I mean,
yeah.
How did that project come together?
So right before going to Egypt for the marathon in January, I decided to spend a few days in Tunisia with my husband. It was right after New Year's, and when I was there, I was contacted by one of the organizers of this ultra marathon called the Ultra Mirage. And they, you know, they read about my project and they were like, wow, we would be so excited if you came to run in the fourth edition of this race. You know, for me, when they contacted me and I was like, oh my gosh, 100-kilometer ultra, I'm still finishing my marathon project now. But I knew that as soon as Run to Reach ended, I would want something big, like a bigger goal to keep going, because I, not that, you know, ending Run to Reach would be this devastating thing. Like, I think a lot of people were like, oh my gosh, are you going to be okay after you finish Run to Reach? But I knew I needed another big goal ahead of me once this project came to an end. So I finished Run to Reach, and immediately after finishing the project, I went straight to Lebanon, which is where my husband is from. And I love traveling there. I'm not sure if you've been there. It's a beautiful country. Yeah. And so I was in Lebanon and sort of just figuring my life out, what I was going to do after Run to Reach. And I was actually there during the very big explosion. So that whole experience was, of course, very life-changing. And, you know, I think when I finished Run to Reach, it was like, at that point, that was the biggest marker in my life. Like, there was life before Run to Reach and life after Run to Reach. And now, like, with this explosion and actually being quite close to the explosion, it was, again, the biggest sort of marker in my life. And at that time, around June, July, you know, I kind of told people I was maybe thinking of doing this ultra race, but I hadn't committed yet. And after sort of surviving the explosion, to be honest, like it puts my life into perspective in a way that I've never sort of had that kind of very like shocking experience.
Were you close to the explosion? The explosion was so big that I imagine it reached many different points, but were you?
I was on the balcony of Mark, my husband's parents' home, and they lived less than a kilometer away from the blast. So it was pretty close. But yeah, and so, you know, their home was, you know, partially destroyed. I don't know how I came out of that experience alive, to be honest. To even take it one step further, like around that time as well, it happened around 6 p.m. almost every single day, I was on a run right next to the port. So while I, you know, talk about my experience being, you know, very, you know, like almost like a near-death experience, I don't know what would have happened to me if I was actually on my run very close to the port. So that was a really, it's still hard for me to find the words to put to that kind of experience. And I ended up staying another 3 weeks in Lebanon after the blast. And I feel really grateful to have had that time there just to be able to start to process what had happened, also talk to other people who, you know, just really be open about the whole experience. But this was all to say too that after that happened, I just felt like all of these things in my life that it's like, oh, maybe I will do that, or maybe I should do that. It was like, you just have to do it. And so I immediately wrote to the race organizers. I was like, is it too late to come? I don't think I'm like trained for it, but I'm going to try. And so maybe I literally trained for this ultra for 1 month beforehand. So, and I do not recommend that at all. But I mean, I knew that I had, you know, a pretty good physical foundation from running all these races. And I also knew I had my mental endurance was feasible for this kind of race as well. I also knew that if I didn't finish this race, it would just be an amazing story no matter what. So I decided to go. The race itself was amazing. I mean, again, just running in the open desert is such a surreal out-of-body experience. And what was interesting about this race in Tunisia, there was a big sandstorm during the race. And so on the one hand, it's maybe like, you know, 36 degrees, which is like 96 degrees Fahrenheit, which I've run in really hot weather, but not like that hot. And, but with this sandstorm, it kind of like, it did sort of provide a bit of like air circulation and wind. And so that helps a lot with the heat. But then, you know, 6 hours into the sandstorm, you just have sand blowing in your face. And it definitely was a really introspective adventure. And I was, you know, I did most of the race by myself. I maybe saw like people in front of me and behind me for half of the race. But then the second half of the race, I was just by myself alone. And you know, of course, during the race, I was cursing myself, like, why did I do this? Why did I get myself in this situation? But then 18 hours later, when I finished the race, I was, you know, really happy. And I'm already excited to do another one. But yeah, ultra running is so different than even marathon running. It's like, you really, like, for me, when I think about the difficulty of this race, it was not physical, it was totally mental. And I think that's actually why I enjoyed it so much, just because I think it really is like, it's so much more than a race. It's like almost this artistic spiritual journey within yourself, which I found to be, yeah, just really beautiful and eye-opening. And I hope to do more of them in the future. I think it was definitely an interesting race as well, because, you know, COVID is not over. We are still absolutely going through this pandemic. And so I was really impressed by just the organization of the race itself. You know, at the aid stations, at the checkpoints, we all had to wear masks, of course. They sprayed you with disinfectant. It was okay. Like, that was, you kind of get to like 65 Ks or like, you know, over 40 miles. And you're like, really, I have to be sprayed with disinfectant right now. But it was really, really well organized. And I don't know how they pulled it off. Because I think even if their race was 1 week later, it would have been canceled. So I feel really grateful to have had the opportunity to do this race given the circumstances. And, you know, I think there was maybe like a 6 month period of time where, of course, all races were canceled. And then there were maybe a few months where some races were on, but I fear that we might be going back into, you know, a lot of races being canceled now again. So I'm really glad I said yes to it. And I had, you know, surprisingly, I could not run the majority of the race, honestly, because there's so much deep sand from the sandstorm. The majority of the race was supposed to be harder surface, but because of the sandstorm, it was all deep, soft sand. So I was like, oh my God, if I try to run this for like 12 hours, I'm just going to lose steam. So by the time, yeah, by the end of the race, I wasn't even that sore, which sounds crazy, but obviously my feet were destroyed by blisters. But I probably, the next ultra I do, I will try to be a little bit more prepared as well.
When you run an ultra like this, is there, yeah, how do they know if you're running into trouble? Like if you get dehydrated or something like that, do you have a cell phone on you so you can call someone?
No. I did buy a local SIM card thinking that like potentially I could call someone, but there was no service at all.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know if you had a transponder on you or something so that at least they know if you're moving, you know, like they could pinpoint where you are.
Yes. I think there was a GPS tracker on your bib. Okay. So if you got lost, I think that they could find you. To be honest, the race was really well marked, better than most trail races that I've run in my life. At night, it did get a little bit tough because you had to really like spot this kind of flickering orange marker. There are definitely maybe like four or five moments where I couldn't spot the marker, and you do get this like, like almost your breath gets taken away from you because you're like, am I like lost in the desert right now? It's a really scary kind of this huge adrenaline rush feeling. But no, ultimately like everything worked out. And you know, the race was very well marked.
Yeah. Yeah. So now what's your next project? Do you have anything in mind? Project. I mean, it's going to be so hard. Well, no, I'm sure you will come up with a good idea, but how are you going to top this off?
Oh, I know. It's hard. And you know, I think when I went into Run to Reach, I was like, this is going to be my life forever. Like this project is going to continue. And I actually learned through this project, as much as like, you know, it was a really growing character development experience for me, because at the end of the day, I'm not someone who likes to put themselves, you know, in the spotlight, or even like being a public figure is not something that I feel comfortable doing at all. So I, you know, ever since Run to Reach ended, I sort of honestly assumed I would have to apply for normal jobs, but, you know, doing things that obviously sort of my life track has shifted, and I was really interested in going sort of more like the working for a women's fund or doing something like that. But very randomly, a few opportunities sort of fell in my lap. Two running campaigns, kind of global running campaigns, were looking for help with sort of, you know, brand strategy and kind of doing all the things that I was doing for Run to Reach, but doing it for their campaign and their project. And then actually one of the NGOs I worked with at the refugee camp in Tindouf, Algeria, contacted me again. And, you know, we really enjoyed working together. So I've just been doing a lot of freelance work for other really cool projects. And it feels, even though, you know, I'm not working for myself 100% any longer, I actually am enjoying it more because I feel like I'm using the skills that I gained from Run to Reach, you know, through the digital marketing and the fundraising and sort of putting them to other really cool initiatives. And in a way, I feel like I'm enjoying it more because I'm not in the spotlight anymore, even though, you know, I still post on Run to Reach. I'm still running races. I am still kind of vocal about certain causes that I want to promote and support. But I'm shifting my energies to other really cool projects that that I love learning about and am really enjoying sort of seeing them grow since I started working with them.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to ask you a question. I'm dying to know this.
Yeah.
So you probably did a lot of research for your 30 marathons.
Yeah.
Which one do you have, or which ones do you have on your bucket list that you would have liked to
have
run, but you couldn't?
Yeah. I still am dying to do the Everest Marathon, and I put a deposit down for that race. So supposedly I can do it anytime in the next 5 years. So I'm still planning to do that marathon. I think it would be so, so beautiful and powerful to be sort of like looking up at Everest and then running this race at base camp. And gosh, other races. Well, the next ultra I'm thinking of doing, it's on this, it's in Sao Tome, which is in Central Africa. And it's a very, I think for me, like any obscure marathons, like I personally, as much as I respect people who do the six stars and the big city marathons and people who, you know, get the BQ and get to participate in Boston, like I love talking to people about their experiences doing it. But for me, like big city marathons just don't excite me as much, I think, just because I'm also not a very competitive runner. I don't even wear a watch. I really try to listen to my body and sort of see how I feel that way instead of getting stressed out by how fast I'm running, etc. So I think when I'm doing big city marathons, I feel like I'm doing it for all the reasons that, you know, I'm not necessarily running for. And so doing these really kind of crazy races in very random countries, it just to me is really exciting because I learn about the place and I get to meet like also very intrepid travelers who are there also doing it. Just give me any, it's like, I feel like there are literally marathons in every single country now. So I think I just need to go back online and just sort of research and find some really crazy ones. And I am there. I like want to experience them all.
We need the pandemic to just go away.
Yes. It is really crazy to think how long this is going to last for. And, you know, when people say, you know, I'm just ready for it to get back to normal, and you have to just think to yourself, like, will it actually ever go back to normal? Like, what is normal any longer, you know? So,
yeah. But the world is changing. Yeah. I think some of the things that changed for race directors will probably stay in place for a while. I think big races, so like, you know, races where you have 30,000, 40,000 people.
Yeah.
It's probably going to take a while for that to come back. But the smaller races will come back.
I hope so. I hope so.
Slowly.
Yeah. And especially ultras, I think, because you are very spaced out.
I was going to say.
Yeah. The social distancing is just like, it just is
it's part normal.
Of it. So, yeah.
It's their bread and butter. There's no corrals or anything like that.
Yeah.
Very nice.
You can find me on Instagram. I'm under my project name, which is Run to Reach, RUNTOREACH. My website is runtoreach.com. And I'm also on Facebook as well as Run to Reach. I'm still fundraising, but I'm not actively doing it since my project ended in June, but I still have my fundraising page open. So of course, if you still want to donate, I'm still absolutely in contact with the majority of the NGOs. So thank you for all your support.
Thank you. I'll put all your links below so people can go there. And I know that you have like digital gifts that people can, that's a really cool idea on your site, like where you can actually say, okay, with this money, this is what you're buying. This is the digital gift you're buying for this, you know, this organization. So that's a really cool idea. I like that.
Yeah.
So I'll put all your links below. When you run Everest Marathon, you have to come back to the show and tell us how it went.
Thank you. I would love that.
Thank you so much. Have a good
night. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Liz. Don't forget to visit the I Run Things community on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And please come back to listen to more episodes. As always, run fearless, you guys.